It is morning. You wake up. You greet your loved ones. You grab the morning paper. And although it seems like any ordinary day, it isn't. For one extraordinary reason.
And that is a clip from the trailer for Independence Day. It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. According to our next guest, we've become completely obsessed with movie trailers, and previews like the one for Independence Day have become a thriving industry all their own.
Jason Kay and Katie Palmer wrote about the evolution of the movie trailer for Wired Magazine, and they both join us now. Jason, hi.
Hi there.
And Katie, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So you've written that the movie trailer has become a genre unto itself. Katie, what do you mean by that?
I think, well, the trailer has always been a genre unto itself, but with the internet and everybody's increasing access to them, they have really thrived and gone in so many different directions. People can find the trailers that they love, and the studios are making them for those particular audiences.
Can you give us a sense of just how big the movie trailer biz has gotten, Jason?
Oh, gosh. Well, we sort of painstakingly, like Katie did the counting, but we tried to get a tally for the number of views for trailers released just this year alone, and we got well over a billion views on YouTube. And if you look at search results on Google, the number of times we've searched for trailers has more than tripled since 2008. So it's growing every day.
And now more and more often you hear from people who don't want to miss the trailers, you know, when they're getting ready for the movie to come out. It's a way to drum up excitement, but sometimes it's enough just to see the trailer, and it doesn't matter if the movie stinks. Do you think that's true, Katie?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think people still care what they see when they go to the theaters, but we certainly have this phenomenon now where some people are disappointed by the movie after they see a trailer. For example, there was this woman, I think, in Australia who tried to sue after she saw the trailer for Drive and was disappointed that it wasn't more of a Fast and Furious type movie. So definitely, sometimes the trailers can be better than the movies themselves.
So who puts together the trailers? How does that work?
Well, that was one of the most interesting parts of this whole reporting process. Today, it's mostly these trailer boutiques, so these small independent outlets that specialize in different genres of movies. So you might have a trailer outfit like Wildcard, for instance, which got the trailer for, or one of the trailers for Wolverine that focuses on summer blockbusters. Or you might have Mark Woolen's outlet based in Santa Monica, and they do a lot of the more Oscar-worthy pictures that come out in the fall. So it's a lot of independent studios, independent outlets that the studios are going to for the trailers.
Now that's interesting in itself. I always assumed that it would be the studio who was splicing it all together. How come they go to these independent places?
It used to be like that. The studios used to have individual boutiques within themselves to create the trailers. But as digital editing software became cheaper and cheaper, it was easier for trailer editors to branch off on their own and create their own small businesses that the studios then, you know, go out to.
Well, we can't really talk about trailers without talking about the legendary voice of Don LaFontaine.
Which we just heard.
Yeah, he is pretty much the voice, or was. He passed away not too long ago, but the voice of movie trailers for a lot of years. Can you tell us a little bit about him, Katie?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody knows who he is, even if they don't know his name. I mean, you hear In a World, and that is Don. He's just permeated trailer culture so thoroughly. We found out that he recorded more than 5,000 trailers by the end of his career. It's just really incredible.
And what is it about his voice? Like, why was he the go-to voice for trailers?
It's hard to say. I mean, there were a number of different voices that were sort of tailored for specific genres of movies. You'll recognize the same narrator for lots of Disney movies. But his, I think, is just the stentorian, very authoritative voice that everybody loves.
Let's take a listen.
In a world, in the year 2017, in a time of tradition.
In a city where anything can happen. In a war that isn't his.
All that stands between a city and a disaster is a man.
A reluctant soldier.
An ex-con.
The perfect enemy.
What if you couldn't remember
the most deadly submarine ever built?
I love his voice. I wonder what it's like to be friends with him. I bet you felt like you were in a movie all the time. Pass the toilet paper.
the funny thing is, you don't hear that sort of exaggerated narration today. It was very particular to the time, mostly the 90s. We still have voiceover today, you don't get that one guy doing these exaggerated narrations.
So what is the trend like now? What are the voiceovers like for these trailers?
It's mostly like, we looked at the several trailers that are contemporary and for the piece, and but you do get some narration. The focus is less on that sort of hyperbolic narration than it is on the themes, and you get some title cards that'll sort of telegraph what the movie's going to be about, which you didn't really see as much when Don was sort of narrating these trailers.
Right. Now you also sort of get the characters narrating for you, so you have little clips of dialogue that'll sort of do the work of the narration. I think, Jason, you had a term for this, but I forget what it was. It was really great.
Oh, gosh, I can't remember. It was probably the character as narrator or something like that. But they do. They try to use the lines from the movie as a kind of de facto narration for the trailer.
Now, you guys have broken it down into different types of trailer. There's not just one trailer. Can you walk us through some of the different categories, Jason?
Categories of trailers, you mean?
Right, like the tweezer, for instance.
Oh, yeah, sure. Back in the 50s, for instance, there were only three types of trailers. So you had the teaser, which is the first, say, minute and a half trailer for the movie, then the trailer itself, and then whenever they used for TV, so we call it the TV spot. But over time, with the introduction of the internet and all this more, all this content that we get today, we see that splintering so many different ways. So now there's a tweezer, which is the latest innovation, which is basically a 6-second teaser for a teaser. So using Vine, the Twitter app that lets you record 6-second videos, one of the movie studios wanted to do a 6-second tweezer for Wolverine. So it's really just a 6-second looped video of the same few shots, and that's teasing a teaser. And I mean, it's kind of like an endless regression. We're going back further and further until, I don't know what the logical conclusion of that is, but 6 seconds is pretty short.
Yeah, 6 seconds is very short. Do people get anything out of it when they're that short?
We asked the guy who cut the trailer if 6 seconds was enough time to tell a story, and he said yes, and the story was that, Wolverine's a bad guy, or Wolverine's kind of a
badass.
Cool guy.
I guess that covers it.
Say what?
I guess that covers it to a certain degree. We're condensing
it
down.
Just, I guess it's about, getting people talking. And even if it's just 6 seconds long, they were able to splice in kind of a really sneaky shot of a character we thought was dead. So, the online conversation starts there.
Well, and speaking of splicing, there are so many more edits now. It seems as though, they've gone crazy with the number of shots that they can get in one trailer.
Absolutely. I think so. We actually plotted this. We watched over 100 different trailers and counted the number of cuts in them. Painstaking work, but worthwhile because we were able to track the increase in the rate of cuts over time. Basically, we're in the ballpark of like 60 cuts per minute, whereas we were more around 20 cuts per minute back in the 30s and 40s. And that's probably mostly a result of the digital editing technology that people are using today.
Well, we're talking trailers now with Jason Kay and Katie Palmer, who wrote the piece, The Gripping, Mind-Blowing, Thrilling Evolution of the Movie Trailer. And we've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we want to know what you think. Are you obsessed with movie trailers? And what's your all-time favorite? Do you make a point of making it to the movie in time to see them? Do you watch them online? Or do you get sick of them waiting for the movie you want? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. We are talking about movie trailers, how they've changed over the years. Let's give a listen to one from a newer generation.
People want to go on the internet and check out their friends, so why not build a website that offers that? Friends, pictures, profiles. I'm talking about taking the entire social experience of college and putting it online.
That's a clip from The Social Network, one of the new generation of movie trailers, as we talk about movie trailers and their evolution with Jason Kay and Katie Palmer, who both write for Wired Magazine. And we open the phone lines and indeed the Facebook page, everything, the email for you to give us your thoughts about movie trailers. Do you have a favorite movie trailer that you just go back to, you think really got you into the movie? And how do you feel when you love the movie trailer, but the movie disappoints? We heard about a lawsuit. I don't know if that's usually the way it goes, but movie trailers are what we're thinking about right now, and you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org or let us know on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's go to Patty, who's joining us right now in Madison. Hi, Patty.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think about trailers?
So I am just a huge fan of movie trailers. I definitely can echo what was said earlier, where I definitely enjoy watching movie trailers sometimes more than I enjoy the actual movie. But really the one that I was really pretty moved by this year was the new Superman trailer.
Why did you like that one?
For a few different reasons. It was really well put together, and it gave a really cohesive look, I think, at the movie, so you were able to get a good feel for what it was all about. It was a lot of quality, and it was very moving. I definitely felt chills after it.
And did you go see the movie? Is it out yet? I don't even know. Is it out yet, Jason and Katie?
It's definitely out.
Did you like it?
Yeah, last month.
Well, the interesting thing about that trailer, and I think the studio would be pleased to hear that you liked it so much, Patty, is that the MPAA gives each studio one trailer a year that's allowed to exceed the 2.5-minute time requirement, and they chose Superman as their one trailer to go longer than that. So it sounds like it was a risk that paid off.
And Jason and Katie, what did you think of the trailer? Do you agree with Patty?
That one definitely struck me as well, I think mostly because of the music. I think with a lot of these superhero movies that are coming out lately, the studios are definitely trying to emphasize the emotional journey of the character versus just sort of like the wham-bam sort of cliffhanger stuff that they would have done in the past for their blockbusters. And I think it's really having an impact on the quality of the trailers and the movies. The music just, it also gave me chills for that one.
Do trailers, I mean, how much do they matter to how successful the movie is? Does it really translate into box office sales, Jason?
Well, I think, Katie, you looked at some of the data for this, didn't you?
Not too closely. I think it's fair to say that the studios monitor the progression of their campaigns very, very closely and sort of modify them as they go along to make sure that they're targeting those audiences that they want. But they sort of keep the impact of their trailers close to the vest.
Well, let's talk for a minute about the internet and social media. Has that changed how trailers are produced? Are they sort of crafted right now in the hopes that they go viral, and that's the whole point?
Absolutely. I mean, you no longer obviously have to go to a movie theater anymore to see a trailer. You can sit in front of your computer and watch it, and not just watch it once, you can watch it again and again and again. So the studios have to invest in trailers that, you know, contain hidden giveaways or, you know, that sort of reward viewers for watching them more than once. So I think the internet, as it, you know, has done with every industry, basically has completely transformed the trailer industry.
What do you mean by hidden giveaways?
Well, for example, in that 6-second teaser we talked about earlier, you see that a shot in the Wolverine teaser of a character that we thought was dead, and if you just saw that in a movie theater and it was, you know, half a second long, you might miss it. But because it's online, people are going to watch it again and again, and they're going to deconstruct all of these trailers, and you literally get shot by shot deconstructions on various websites. So you can see that shot, you can unpack it, what's the trailer trying to say? Is she actually alive? So they have to throw in these sort of Easter eggs for obsessive fans.
Yeah, when you mention that, it makes me think of Star Trek's trailer and how at the very end there was a villain like no other villain, and then you get the shot of Benedict Cumberbatch and, you know, everyone's turning around, is it Khan? Is it Khan?
Right.
So it kind of worked that way. Yeah.
And the same thing happened with Wolverine as well. You didn't get the shot, like a really clear shot of the Nemesis, the Silver Samurai, until the first trailer got released months after that first teaser was released. So it rewards watching of all of the different trailers that are released over time in the lead up to a movie.
And that's the interesting thing. I mean, the way trailer campaigns were characterized to us is that they're sort of a snowball rolling down a hill. So they're gathering all this information, and it eventually gets to the bottom of the hill, and you have all of this stuff to use, and then finally you just have to see the movie because you've been seeing over the course of several months, even, you know, a couple of years, all of this buildup of material. So all that's left is to see the film itself.
And that's the way they hope it works.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Ian from Barron County. Hi, Ian.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how about you?
Good, good. When I think of movie trailers, I just think of my friend Josh, who raved to me about the Cloverfield trailer, because you just had this clip of a group of friends and then...
Oh, no. Ian, we lost you in the middle of your comment there, but do you guys have any thoughts about the Cloverfield trailer?
I don't know if I've seen that one. Have you, Jason?
No, only that I know Cloverfield was a terrible movie, so I stayed away.
So it's like the trailer then was probably better than the film. Sorry we lost you, Ian. We'll go to Chris in Trempolo next. Hi, Chris.
Good afternoon, folks.
Hello.
Something about seeing John McClane in the Die Hard trailers be himself just sucks you right into the basically Bruce Willis as an actor. I remember seeing the first Die Hard movie when I was about 6, and ever since then, I've been a big fan of all of his movies. But it was that original trailer of Die Hard 2 that I saw when I went to the theaters as a kid that really pulled me into it.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for that thought, Chris. And it's interesting how long Don remembered that trailer. That's from a while ago, Die Hard. Do you remember those?
Absolutely. Original Die Hard trailers? Can't say that I do. But the interesting thing is, we were talking to one guy who said that the shelf life for trailers is basically no more than 10 years, and they become basically irrelevant after that time. So it's interesting that you can remember a trailer that far back, with a few exceptions. There are some classic trailers from the course of history, but standards change so much that trailers basically become irrelevant after a few years.
10 years seems like a pretty long shelf life to me. I think it's about as long as a Twinkie. That's pretty long. And we have, speaking of classic trailers, we haven't talked too much about the past, but let's listen to one that I think most people will recognize.
From the thrilling pages of world-renowned author C.S. Forrester's story and filmed in the jungles and at the headwaters of Africa, the Dark Continent, in all the magnificence of color by Technicolor, comes the most exciting adventure ever screened.
And that, of course, The African Queen, which was not many edits. I don't know, maybe there were 5 edits in that one. What do you think about that one, Katie?
I mean, that's just a perfect example of the old style of trailers that were mostly created by the National Screen Service, which sort of held a monopoly on trailer production back in the 40s and 50s. They had a very classic formula. It was basically just like, this is the best movie in the world, and you're going to want to see it and see all of your favorite stars. Come see the movie.
Yeah, showcase, there was Humphrey Bogart, and that's what it was about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left, and we haven't talked about the phenomenon of fans taking over the whole process and making their own trailers, and sometimes they get mistaken for the actual studio product. Jason, can you talk a little bit about fan trailers?
Sure. I mean, there's all different kinds. Fans are putting together parody trailers. They're putting together, they're changing the genre of a movie and say, you know, make The Shining into a romantic comedy, for instance. And then they're just doing, you know, regular recuts of the trailers that the studios release. And one of the interesting takeaways from our reporting was that some trailer editors actually look to fan trailers to see, you know, who's doing it really well, the next generation of trailer editors. So they've actually hired random, you know, people who put out fan trailers to come and work for them in Hollywood.
So if you're a studio and you've got a movie and you've got a trailer out there that people are mistaken for your actual, you know, bona fide trailer, is that a good thing? Is it good publicity or is it annoying?
I would have to guess that they would be a little annoyed by that, given how carefully they craft these these campaigns. But overall, if you've got fans that are engaging that thoroughly in your content and taking it apart and piecing it back together again, it's got to be a net positive.
And guys, we've only got about 30 seconds left. Do you each want to offer up your vote for best trailer ever? I know you got a list on your article. Katie, we'll start with you.
Well, we actually talked about this together and independently came up with the same exact answer, which I thought was pretty cool.
So what is it?
And it's in the article, Wired chooses the best trailer, and it's also our personal pick, and that's the original teaser for Alien back in the 1970s.
Alien, excellent. All right, we'll have to check that one out. Jason and Katie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
We're talking to Jason Kay and Katie Palmer. They both write for Wired Magazine, and their piece, The Gripping, Mind-Blowing, Thrilling Evolution of the Movie Trailer, is linked to on our Facebook page.
Coming up next, we'll talk about an outbreak of foodborne illness in Texas and the Midwest could be spreading. We'll try to find out why and what it is. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we continue with the next installment of our six-part series on heroin from WPR News.
But first, another foodborne illness outbreak in Texas may be linked to the cyclospora cases affecting over 170 people in Iowa, Nebraska, Wisconsin, and Illinois.
We'll see how these outbreaks are investigated. Our guest was a former senior advisor on produce safety to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.
Dr. Jim Gorney is vice president of food safety and technology for the Produce Marketing Association. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica. Thank you, Rob, for having me on the show.
Well, tell us about cyclospora. What exactly is it?
Cyclospora is actually a parasite, and it's pretty endemic to the Central America, to tropical and subtropical region. Many people would know it as traveler's diarrhea.
So there's nothing pleasant about that. And how sick do people get with it?
Well, you typically get stomach cramps, nausea, fatigue, that type of thing, and it's quite unpleasant. It typically will, you know, doesn't hurt people badly, but it still is very unpleasant and not a good thing to have.
Do cases like this break out more often in the summer months?
Yes and no. Actually, cyclospora is a fairly rare foodborne illness or waterborne illness in the United States, again, because it's typically found in tropical and subtropical environments. So you rarely see cases of cyclospora in the United States, to be honest with you, and certainly not the 206 or so that have been reported as of today.
So how are we doing on identifying a cause for this most recent outbreak?
Well, as a former person at FDA, I can tell you that state officials and the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta are obviously working very hard right now using a number of tools that are available to them. One is epidemiology. One is tracing the food back to its origin and then looking at samples to see if there's any contamination that can be found. And what I mean by epidemiology is they're actually going out and interviewing sick individuals, talking to their meal companions, people who ate with them, and asking them what they ate. And you can imagine that's a difficult job, one, tracking people down, and two, trying to get people to remember what they ate a number of weeks ago, which could have caused the illness. And, you know, I can't remember what I ate for dinner last night, so it's a difficult job.
You know, it seems like whenever we hear about cases like these, and sometimes this sounds like a milder version of some of the things that we sometimes see with foodborne illnesses, sometimes there are deaths involved, that people start looking at the huge business of our modern food industry and how, you know, one plant in California can feed the whole country. And in that case, you know, the advocates come out and say, well, if we just ate local, we wouldn't be having these problems. What's your response to that sort of conversation that comes up around this?
Well, I think foodborne illness and these bacteria and parasites, they really don't know boundaries. So they don't know if they're on a small farm or a large farm, whether they're in a big factory or a small factory that's producing food. I think it depends on what the practices are in that particular facility and in that particular farm. I've been all over the world. I've been to places like Guatemala and Mexico and other places, and I've been to production areas in California, and there's good farms and there's bad farms, and there's good producers and bad producers. And I don't think it knows geographic boundaries or enterprise size.
So you could get sick from that farmer's market cucumber just the same as you could from, you know, a cucumber in a bag from a big grocer.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the issue is that our surveillance network, the public health officials who are looking for these illnesses, if someone does get sick from, for example, a farmer's market, Very few people would get sick, and it would almost never be picked up in our surveillance network out there in public health, where, you know, typically if, you know, lots of people get sick, that's going to be picked up by our surveillance network of testing.
So how close do you think we are to figuring this out? Are there ever cases where we never find out where the source of contamination is?
Yeah, unfortunately, sometimes they do lead to dead ends. So I'm sure FDA and the state officials are working very hard right now to identify that potential food source. And again, they're interviewing people. They'll be doing some statistics to try and figure out what the likely food source is. They'll be taking food samples out of ill individuals' refrigerators and testing those. They'll also be trying to link them, you know, those NCIS-type tools that you see on TV with genetic fingerprints. They'll also be using those to see if these illnesses that have recently popped up in Wisconsin are related to the outbreak in Nebraska and Texas and throughout the Midwestern United States. So they're using all those tools, but unfortunately, unlike NCIS, they take time. They don't happen within an hour.
Yeah, we were talking about just that angle at our editorial meeting this morning about how you go about tracing things back. And I guess one question we have is there such a thing as a food fingerprint?
You know, not yet. But certainly we're getting there. Certainly some of these labels that you see on foods, the universal product codes called UPCs and others, typically, you know, on some of those, you'd be able to go all the way back to the field for some systems. Unfortunately, they're not universal per se. So, but we are moving towards that, where you'll be able to pick up an item in your grocery store, and there are systems that are available today where you can actually see which farm it was produced on.
So it seems as though every year there are several stories like this, and sometimes it's cyclospora, sometimes it's something that's more severe that actually causes deaths. And when it happens like that, you get a lot of fear around food and people being, you know, a little afraid about the food they're eating and where it's sourced. And you've been really close to this for a lot of years. How safe do you feel about eating the food that's on shelves?
I think our food supply in the United States is very, very, very safe. The issue is that we consume billions and billions of servings every day, and you know, certainly a small handful are potentially contaminated. But there's a number of things consumers can do to really help themselves, and it's a really simple message. It's clean, cook, chill, and separate. So what I mean by that is, with regard to clean, make sure your hands are clean. Make sure that food contact surfaces in your kitchen are clean. With regard to cook, make sure you're cooking foods to proper temperatures, for example, beef to 145 degrees Fahrenheit. Chill, and I think that's important this time of year to refrigerate things promptly, because it's so warm and we're experiencing these heat waves, that you get things in the refrigerator so bacteria can't grow on your food, and separate. You know, make sure that you're using a separate cutting board, and make sure you separate produce items from raw meat products, for example, when you go to the grocery store. So cook, clean, chill, and separate are really the key.
And if we do that, we can say we're reasonably protected. It's safe to eat what we eat.
Well, I think that's what consumers can do. I think that's the important part, because consumers really have to rely on everybody in the food chain with regard to that they've done their proper job in making sure that the food that they're purchasing and consuming is safe. And consumers need to take it to the last step. They have some responsibilities, too, and that's, again, cook, clean, chill, and separate. So that's really important, so they don't hurt themselves or their families.
And what about food producers? Are they being told to step it up at all, or is what we're seeing just sort of par for the course?
Absolutely. I think certainly none of these producers want to see their consumers injured. That's just a very poor business strategy, and it's not a good idea. Secondly, there is the Food Safety Modernization Act, which was passed by Congress in 2011, and there are new proposed rules from the Food and Drug Administration relating to produce safety, relating to manufacturing of foods, and relating to the import of foods. So the bar is being raised, and also industry takes it very seriously, because ill consumers just are not a good business plan.
All right. So we've got some precautions there we can take, and hopefully they'll track this one down and we'll get an answer. Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity, and have a good weekend.
You too. We've been talking with Dr. Jim Gorney, Vice President of Food Safety and Technology for the Produce Marketing Association and former Senior Advisor on Produce Safety to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.
Coming up, we continue our WPR News series on heroin, today looking at the drug as a public health issue. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're continuing our heroin series today by taking a look at how the epidemic is being dealt with in our state's capital.
Most places are primarily dealing with heroin use as a criminal issue. In Madison and Dane County, there's also a heavy focus on heroin as it affects public health. As Shemaine Mills reports, a nonprofit is leading the effort.
It might seem odd that a group which helps prevent falls among the elderly is tackling heroin, but avoiding injury and preventable death is what the nonprofit group Safe Communities is all about. In the past, they've addressed pedestrian safety and suicide. A visual example of heroin's increasing impact on the public is something most don't associate with drug use, driving. Safe Communities Director Cheryl Wickey says it's a big issue.
People will shoot up. As soon as they get their heroin, they shoot up. They don't wait till they get home. And then they pass out in the car, crash in the car. And that's been a very visible sign of an increase in the problem.
A former heroin user agrees.
It's a very dangerous thing. With the amount of traffic that's on the road nowadays, it's extremely dangerous.
That's 34-year-old Kelly Graycheck. This summer, he was invited to talk to a Madison church group, sending chills down spines with his personal revelations.
My father was a drug dealer. My father went to federal prison for 13 years. So I, at actually 5, 6 years old, I was raided by a SWAT team.
Authorities say Graycheck isn't necessarily the typical heroin user. Many are middle and upper class kids, says Julie Rortvedt. She's a Madison police detective. She holds community forums on heroin and has been disappointed with the low turnout. Rortvedt thinks families see it as an internal problem.
So what I'm finding is that they suffer in isolation, feeling like they're alone. They don't want to tell their other friends about what's going on because it's embarrassing. There's some stigma with it.
Yet Rortvedt says people seem increasingly willing to talk about heroin as it becomes more widespread, along with the diseases from shared needles. Graycheck, who served 7 months in prison for dealing heroin, nevertheless calls himself lucky because he didn't get an incurable disease from using.
You know, I got lucky. I am HIV negative and I don't have hepatitis C, but some other people don't get so lucky.
Part of Madison's approach is to prevent drug-related infection. Last year, Madison's health department gave out 28,000 sterile needles and syringes. Mary Jo Hussey coordinates the HIV program for Madison-Dane County Public Health.
It's on our website. We don't hide that we do it. And if you Google needle exchange in Dane County, our website pops up.
The AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin also distributes clean needles in Madison and around the state. Prevention Director Scott Stokes says since they started the program in 1995, there's been a 67% drop in HIV infections related to injection drug use.
So we know it's having a huge impact there.
Stokes says there's more hepatitis, so more work is required to control it. Hussey says needle exchange appears to be preventing its spread in Madison, but the practice has its critics.
It doesn't make sense to them, and I understand that. But I do think it's important to realize there's absolutely no evidence that this increases drug use or encourages someone to start using drugs.
She points out both AIDS and hepatitis are lifelong infections that are expensive for the community to treat. Needle exchange is a recommended intervention of the Centers for Disease Control. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks to Shemaine for the latest installment on the WPR News series on heroin in Wisconsin.
And here with us now to talk further about the public health approach is Cheryl Wittke, Executive Director of Safe Communities. Cheryl, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you focus on public health issues. How does heroin fall under that umbrella?
Well, as with all of these issues, and I think your report this week has really demonstrated the complexity of it. There's lots of different components, and the folks that you just talked to in your report about Dane County represent a lot of different perspectives and needs that need to be taken into account in addressing this.
And so when did Safe Communities decide to take this up?
Well, we noticed, actually, thanks to data from the Public Health Department, that prescription opiates and opiates in general had increased dramatically. It exceeds traffic crashes as our number one cause of injury death in Dane County.
Hmm.
And so that was alarming. And we also had tremendous leadership from the city of Madison mayor and the county executive, the law enforcement community, the treatment community. Everybody sort of came together, the healthcare community, to recognize that this was a problem that needed a more coordinated solution. And since Safe Communities has worked in other areas, including suicide and traffic crashes, we have an infrastructure in place to coordinate those sorts of efforts.
Can you describe what that coordinated effort would look like for heroin?
Yeah, well, it starts, too, with the data. And what the data tells us is that actually prescription opiates are a gateway to heroin. And today, the number of overdose deaths from the opiate pain relievers, such as OxyContin and Percocet, those sorts of things, far surpass the number of deaths from heroin and cocaine combined. So part of it is sort of also shifting the focus a little bit to what is killing people, you know, or how are people starting with heroin, and so trying to look at sort of a supply and demand approach to this. So reducing the supply of prescription drugs and heroin in the community, and then reducing the demand through treatment and prevention sorts of efforts.
So how do you reduce the amount of prescription opiates out there? Do you lobby? Is that part of it?
It's really working with the healthcare community, and they're very active partners in this. We have a healthcare task force that's looking at how can we reduce the numbers of opiates that are out there, and how can we screen people for potential problems with addiction before these prescription opiates are prescribed. So actually, if you look at this nationwide, there's been a tremendous increase in the number of prescription opiates dispensed, and it tracks exactly with the numbers of overdose deaths and hospitalizations. And that's happened for some really good reasons, and that is that as a community, we're committed to treating pain, and we really don't want to stop doing that. But on the other hand, there's been a tremendous increase in the numbers of opiates, percentages of folks taking opiates. If you just look since 1997, for example, with oxycodone, there's been a 588% increase between 97 and 2005 in the numbers of opioid medications prescribed oxycodone. So just the fact that we have that many opiates in the community in people's medicine chests, and they're so easily accessible and so highly addictive, that's one of the reasons why we've seen this increase in both prescription drug misuse, and then as people can't get those anymore, turning to heroin sort of situation.
Well, it's easy to see that if someone with a tendency toward addiction has this in their medicine cabinet from their doctor, they have a higher chance of developing a substance abuse problem. But why do you think there are so many more of these prescriptions being written?
Well, as I said, because it was a very legitimate response to what some people felt was the medical community's sort of inadequate response to dealing with people's chronic pain.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a movement among patients that was supported by the medical community to make sure that people who were in chronic pain were getting the treatment that they needed. And, you know, it's been, I think, sort of a pendulum swing. Some people would say that there was a time when they were under-treating pain. Now people might be saying the pendulum has swung a bit too far the other direction, where there's a little bit too liberal of a dispensation of these very powerful medicines, and there needs to be more of a balanced approach to it. So part of what we're doing as a community coalition is educating clinicians. So November 1st in Madison, we'll have a training will be one of only 10 in the nation. That's a scope of pain training for clinicians, and anybody who prescribes opiates is welcome to attend this, from dentists to primary care physicians, to have education on safe and competent prescribing of opiates. So that's one piece of what we're trying to do. And then the other piece, of course, is educating people in the community about the risks of opiates. There can be sort of a casual, well, I'll keep it around in case I need it, or my friend is having some pain, so I'll loan them my leftovers. That's a very dangerous practice. And so we're trying to get the word out that that's not something that folks should be doing, for both their personal safety and community safety. And then also we formed a parent addiction network, and we have wonderful resources that were pulled together by parents treatment professionals, people in the criminal justice system, to support families that are dealing with addiction. So that's parentaddictionnetwork.org, if folks would like to go on there and look at all of the different sort of resources that are available.
Well, so going back to safe communities, obviously you're approaching this from a different angle than law enforcement. What can public health initiatives like this do that law enforcement can't?
We really partner together with law enforcement, and I think that's been a beautiful thing about our partnership with all of the Dane County law enforcement agencies, is that they see that their role is one of law enforcement, of interdiction, and they're very willing to partner with other community organizations to address the other underlying issues. And there's a cool treatment law enforcement initiative that we're trying to launch here that really initiated in the Madison Police Department and with the Narcotics and Gang Task Force, where basically they're identifying folks through arrest who might want to get into treatment, and then they're making referrals directly to treatment. So that, I think, is a great model and an indication of the sorts of partnerships that are in place.
And Cheryl, I've only got about 15 seconds for your answer, but how is Wisconsin responding so far?
Well, I think, Wisconsin, we really started at the local level thanks to some leadership at the state level. And for folks who are interested in starting a local initiative like ours, I would recommend they look at a document called Reducing Wisconsin's Prescription Drug Abuse, a call to action that was put out by the state in January of 2012. And that gives a lot of tips to local governments, local coalitions like ours, on how to address this issue.
All right. Well, Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking with Cheryl Whitke, Executive Director of Safe Communities.
On Monday, we'll wrap up our heroin series by taking a look at drug courts. They're prosecuting cases while trying to be sensitive to addiction.
Also coming up on Monday on Central Time, we'll take a look at how technology is changing the workplace and what jobs are available.
And we'll discuss issues surrounding prisons in Wisconsin and the U.S. Throughout the week, starting on Monday.
That's coming Monday on Central Time. Coming up after the news, our guests will share their passion for peaches, growing them, eating them, and cooking with them. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.